Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hippie Witch, magic for a new age. I'm your host, Joanna DeVoe, and this is a happy, hippie place where magic with a K meets the law of attraction. Hi, thanks for joining me for episode 85 of Hippie Witch, magic for a new age. My name is Joanna DeVoe, and I am the shadow working, deep soul diving, archetype grooving creatrix behind Kick-Ass Witch, putting the K in magic, and of course, Hippie Witch, the show you are listening to right now. I also have a free ebook by that name, Hippie Witch, Peace, Love, and All That Good Shit, and you can pick up a copy of that at www.joannadebow.com, and I've put a link to that on the description page for this episode back at Blog Talk Radio. And today, I want to talk about a subject that is very close to my heart and that I feel touches the lives of us all of us, especially in today's modern technology-driven climate, and that is the addict archetype, which I dubbed for the purposes of this show an archetype for modern living. If you think that the addict archetype is not relevant to you or your life, I urge you to think again, and here's why. If you are a member of modern society, and seeing as you are listening to a podcast right now, I feel that it's safe to assume that you are a member of modern society. And what I'm trying to pose today is that because of this technology-driven climate that we are living in modern society, addiction, the addict archetype, is a part of our lives in some less than obvious ways. So I hope that you will reconsider your relationship to this archetype, even if you're not addicted to drugs or you're not an alcoholic or a sex addict. There are other ways that this addict can show up in your lives. Obviously, it can show up in your lives with relationship to people who are addicts, but you might be surprised to find the addict lurking in your own shadow as well. And if you are new to the subject of archetypes, I recommend going back through the archives here to the 5 shows that I did on shadow work and archetypes last October 2013. The first one in particular, Archetypes and Mythology, is a Path to Understanding, will give you a really nice overview, but I repeat in all those episodes like what an archetype is. The other 4 shows are broken up into what Carolyn Mace calls the 4 archetypes of survival, the victim, the saboteur, the prostitute, and the child. And we supposedly all have these archetypes at play in our system. They are universal. Her book that I just did a Book Nerd Weekly post on yesterday, Sacred Contracts, gets into this in depth. If you want to check that out, also highly recommend it. But what she was saying about how we all have these archetypes at play in our system, I actually feel that way about the addict as well, especially in today's modern age. And like I said, you don't have to be addicted to drugs or alcohol, sex, or food to have this addict running amok in your shadow. It could be present in those of us who feel the need, for example, to check our phones or our social media 82 times a day. I just heard Robert Ojeda talking about this in his Mercury Retrograde in his Mercury Retrograde in Libra Scorpio series that I was so happy to download and have listened to twice now. Love Robert Ojeda, as you probably know by now. That's a really good series. But he was talking about, I forget how many times he said the average person checks their phone every day, and I'm pretty sure it was way more than 82 times, which is shocking, but for whatever reason, that's the number that is stuck in my head, so let's just go with it. He posed a very interesting question around this phenomenon, which was, what else do you do 82 times a day? Do you eat 82 times a day? Do you brush your teeth 82 times a day, work out, go to the bathroom, unless you have a clinical case of OCD? No, you don't. So why is it that we think nothing of checking Facebook that many times? Do you know how many times a day you look at your phone? Do you even know? And wouldn't it be interesting to actually track that for a few days to find out? And even more interestingly, do you know why you check Facebook or Twitter or your phone 82 times a day or however many times you find out you are doing it? I hope you'll track that. I think it would be a really interesting experiment. And then, like I'm saying now, it would be interesting to ask yourself, why? Why am I doing this? What is driving that behavior? What are you hoping to achieve by doing that? What kind of hit do you get when you do that? And, you know, what is the lure there? And I wonder, too, if maybe it isn't causing a bit of an emotional roller coaster, you know. If you check and you see what it is you're hoping to see, or you check and you don't, is there a payoff there, or is there a letdown? Just some food for thought, some things to explore on your own. I think that the internet has brought out the addict in full force for all kinds of people in all different ways. It can show up as shopping addictions, stocking addictions, and I am not talking about stockings as in ladies' footwear. Stocking addiction, STALK. I'm talking about the urge to research your friends and family and enemies and exes online ad nauseum. There is a new sitcom called A to Z that just did an episode on this. These two people, they were like newly dating, and one of them actually works for a dating website. It was about, this whole episode was about how the internet has made it so that you can check people's whole, their arrest records, their whole history on Google. Apparently there are sites now where you can read what their ex-girlfriends or boyfriends had to say about who they were in those relationships. It's like we're a culture of stalkers now because of the internet. What has this done to our sex lives, I wonder? And that truly deserves a show unto itself. I don't even know how to fit a show like that into 30 minutes, a show on sex addiction and how porn addiction is really driving that in our culture. But suffice it to say, porn addiction is rampant, and it is affecting who we are and how we relate to each other or don't relate to each other and ourselves offline. And this is no joke, especially if you have teenagers or children that are about to be teenagers. This is something to be really present to and aware of and have a strategy in place that you can protect your kids from this stuff. Video games have done something similar. We are training our children to expect a kind of instant gratification that is nowhere near replicable in the real world. And I also, I just want to throw out the word selfie, because I think there might be selfie addicts now. I think this might be a new addiction, and I wonder what that might be about. The need for validation, the need to be seen, the need to be seen and validated. There are forms of addiction, selfie addiction, that I think are harder to identify, but nonetheless alienating, emotionally alienating at the very least, which is, in my opinion, one of the hallmarks of addiction. Addiction alienates you from other people. It's isolating, and it can make your world smaller. So what else might this look like? The need to be right. What about the need to be right? This is something that I am a total know-it-all. I will admit it. I have struggled with the need to be right. And for me, that was really brought to light for me and illuminated when I really got into the YouTube community, when I was first involved in that community. I would, like, argue with people about like the dumbest stuff, you know, spiritual ideas and stuff like that. And the thing about being a know-it-all is, like, you're totally going to bump egos with other know-it-alls. You seem to find each other, like attracts like. You can just go on forever. And I did notice myself doing that after the first year or so. And it actually took a great deal of effort to stop and to just let that go. And then there was quite a period where I had to make the effort to do that, where I didn't actually feel a charge when somebody would challenge me. Or when they would say something that I wanted to challenge, and it really took a long time to get that charge out of my system. But the need to be right. Anyway, this isn't about me. This is about us all. So I'm really going to try to stay on task here and not go on too many tangents like that. But the need to be right, the way that that shows up in all manner of conversation, if you have the addict archetype up in that need to be right, the way it shows up both on and offline is most certainly alienating. The way that it can have you trampling over other people's point of view or forcing yourself on others in a loud, obtrusive way and forever defending your position. And let's face it, the way that the need to be right often defends its position is by embodying that whole tactic of offense is the best defense. It can be a really aggressive way to make your way through a family dinner, for example. The way the need to be right presents itself is certainly alienating. And the need to control, it looks like that too, right? The need to control, the addict, the need to be right. These seem to all be tied up together. And for me, the need to control is another hallmark of addiction. Addiction represents the attempt to assert control over our lives, complete control, which, let's face it, is impossible. It's impossible to control everything in your life, your moods, your pleasure, other people's opinions of you. But the addict tries. The addict tries and tries and tries, and it never gives up, ever. Every time an alcoholic reaches for a drink, they are attempting to control their lives. From the outside looking in, it might look like their lives are out of control because of the alcohol. But they are seeing it as a way of controlling their environment, controlling their emotions, controlling their experience. The same with sex addicts. They're trying to control, gosh, so many things. It could be different for each sex addict, obviously. It could be about controlling other people. It could be about being in control of their own pleasure. It could be about all kinds of different things. So I won't even go there because, like I said, that's a whole show unto itself. But going back to this idea of how, you know, there are other forms of addiction besides the obvious ones that we all think of when we hear the word addict, another thing that comes to mind is the seemingly softer desire, the seemingly softer desires of people pleasers. Someone who has the addict in their people pleaser, if that could be considered an archetype. Do you think that being a people pleaser is entirely innocent, this need to please? Isn't it just a desire to control other people's reactions to you, to make them like you? And what if they don't? What then? What if, despite your best efforts to make me like you, I don't? How is that going to make you feel? If you are a people pleaser with a side order of the addict, it might just make you try even harder, which might just push me away even further and create that sense of alienation that I think, again, is really common for the addict. And addictions can show up in so many ways that are not always obvious at first glance. So this is something that I think is really, I mean, not all the time, every day, to be vigilant about, but when you're considering the addict archetype, when you're considering how it might be at play in your life, to be vigilant about it in that moment and to really, like, lift up all the little rocks and look in all the nooks and crannies and get real with yourself and see how this might be showing up for you. You can be addicted to the news. You can be addicted to conspiracy theories, sports, exercise, the drive to be seen as important, or just to be seen. Again, if you're wondering if something less obvious, like the need to please, the need to be right, or the constant craving for attention that might lead you to making a fool out of yourself more times than not, if you're wondering if this might be a way that the addict is showing up for you, a good place to start might be, you know, in making that assessment is just to ask yourself, is this alienating other people? Have you self-selected down to a tiny group of people that either share or feed this addiction, if it is that? An even better question might be, is, are you able to stop? And I suggest that you don't just answer this question verbally, because the reality might not match your intellectual answer. You might be like, of course I can stop taking selfies and posting them on the internet. If you think that's true, I invite you to try. Stop. If you say you can stop, then stop. Just stop for a period of time and see if that doesn't create some sort of emotional unrest in you. Like, are you feeling like people are going to forget you if you don't keep posting your face all over the internet? Do you miss them telling you, oh, you're so beautiful, you look so young, you're so gorgeous, blah, 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 blah? Are you just missing that interaction on the internet that maybe you could be getting in your real life? These are just suggestions. I don't know. I don't know if you're a selfie addict. I'm just using that as an example. So what might the light side of addiction be? What might the opposite of addiction look like? Or what might the lesson in it be? Because I believe when you do shadow work, when you look at these archetypes, these aspects of yourself, they all have their light and dark side. So what might that be for addiction? I'm thinking freedom. I'm going to say freedom. Freedom from the need to control whatever that is. The need to control your moods, your emotions, your pleasure, other people. Freedom from that relationship. Freedom from the bottle. Freedom from that chemical, freedom from the urge, that incessant bully of a voice in your head that tells you you need to do this thing one more time, and then one more time, and then really just one more time, times infinity. Oh, it's exhausting, right? Gerald G. May. I believe he was a psychiatrist. I often get psychiatrists and psychologists mixed up, so forgive me if I'm confusing that, but he was also a wonderful author who wrote a book on the subject of addiction, and he's just cool. He wrote a book on The Dark Night of the Soul. I'm saying that you should go to Amazon and put Gerald G. May in a search, because I can't remember the name of these books, but they're very good. He's very good. His book on addiction is super interesting, and I wrote a couple of quotes down from it because I thought that they were valid to this idea of maybe freedom as being the light side of addiction. And he says, addiction abuses our freedom and makes us do things we really do not want to do. While repression stifles desire, addiction attaches desire, bonds and enslaves the energy of desire to certain specific behaviors, things, or people. These objects of attachment then become preoccupations and obsessions, and they come to rule our lives. So that's like the opposite of freedom, enslavement, having a chemical or the need to please or whatever it is, rule your life, make decisions for you in a way to where you aren't in control despite your, you know, best efforts to control. You're out of control. He also says, our addictions are our own worst enemies. They enslave us, there's that word again, with chains that of our are of our own making. They enslave us with chains that are of our own making. And yet that, paradoxically, are virtually beyond our control. So even though we make these chains, we can't seem to find a way to get them off of us. And I just want to say about Gerald G. May, he does take like a God-centric take on things. He'll use the word God a lot. He'll even make biblical references, but he actually gives an overview of a number of different religions, everything from Islam to Buddhism to Taoism. He includes it all. And his, for me, when I see the word God in print, it depends on the person, but he does it in a way that I don't find off-putting at all. And so if you have a problem with that word, but you're curious about his work, I suggest checking it out anyways, maybe just replacing the word God for the universe in your own mind, or goddess, or whatever it is for you, because he's got a really conversational, easy-to-understand human way of combining the psychological with the spiritual, which is what I'm all about, psycho-spiritual. He integrates the two, linking psychological discoveries that he's made as a psychiatrist or a psychologist, with these spiritual traditions, myths, and texts that he often talks about. So I just think that's so interesting, and he's a great writer on that subject. He talks about how detachment is the liberation of desire, and that's a word that if you've studied yoga or Buddhism, you're going to come across a lot. Detachment, detaching from your desires, detaching from your addictions. I think detachment, the law of non-attachment, yes, that is one of the principles in the seven laws of spiritual success, which was my first Deepak Chopra book. But I think another way to say detachment is just good old-fashioned surrender. Which you know, probably, I'm not saying you know. If you've been following me closely, you know surrender is the word that I've been working with since my birthday at the end of September, and I'm going to be working with it all year long, and it has already just rocked my world. I guess this is something that I really needed to do in my life. Surrender. 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 And perhaps what I was saying is addiction, maybe the light in this shadow or shedding light on this shadow acts as a catalyst for surrender. How many times have you heard that addiction brought somebody to their knees? What does it mean to be brought to your knees? To me, it means surrender. You might see this as a surrender to God or goddess, or you might just see it as a surrender to your soul. Do you really think that your soul can be addicted to anything? Because I don't. I think that addiction is a uniquely human experience that is separate from our soul. Although our soul is in there, you know. We can't separate ourselves from our soul. Let me rewind and take that back. But it is uniquely human. It's about the lessons we're learning here in this human experience. It's our attempt to play God rather than recognizing that we are, in fact, already God, or at least a part of it, the one, the universe, the mysterious creative force that connects all things. So what comes after surrender? So you're down on your knees. You're surrendering to the power of this addiction that you feel so powerless to. I think that there are a few things that you can do beyond surrender. I think we like to do things, and it's an extension of surrender. So if you're going to surrender a particular addiction, maybe you could replace it with a new healthy habit or just a new passion. You know, maybe your addiction has been hogging your psyche. It's been taking up all this space and all this room, and it's edged out a true desire that you've held in your heart since you were a child to be a writer or a dancer or to have your own business or to volunteer at the local shelter, whatever it is. So, you know, maybe surrendering the addiction will make room for a new passion. And maybe in picking up that new passion and pouring your energy into that, all of the energy that you used to pour into your addiction, maybe that will make that process a lot easier and gentler for you. So you're not sitting around in your room going, my God, I really need a cigarette right now, because you're too busy down at the local soup kitchen serving your community and connecting with real human beings. Another thing, speaking of soup, that I think can really help, this is particularly true of people with chemical addictions, whether your addiction is born of some chemical imbalance that you had prior to it or previous to it, or if you've just thrown your chemistry out of whack by engaging in your addiction with alcohol or drugs or sex, something like that. And that is addiction nutrition. There is actually a place called the Center for Nutrition Addiction, at least online. I do not personally have experience with this organization, but I am so damn happy that it exists. CenterForNutritionAddiction.com. Go check it out if you're curious. But judging by what I have seen on their website, our philosophies on this topic are very well aligned. I have learned how addiction and food are related in my own life, in the lives of my loved ones, and the person that taught me about that was Julie Ross, MD, who I mention frequently. Her book, The Mood Cure, is phenomenal when it comes to this subject. My friend Jennifer Seitzer has just really honed in on this idea in her own business and is starting to talk about addiction nutrition, so I'm really excited to see where she's going to go with that. But I will say for alcoholics in particular, this is really important because a lot of alcoholics turn to sugar, which really just keeps the mood swings and the hormone imbalances and the liver problems going, just like the alcohol does. It does the same thing. It can create candida imbalances in your body, and those mood swings and, you know, hormonal swings, that just further perpetuates the feelings of shame that are so naggingly present for the addict. And I should mention, I was talking about hallmarks of the addict archetype, and shame, that's got to be at the top of the list. That's got to be the number one. So if you're having problems with mood swings after, you know, surrendering a certain addiction, go look into addiction nutrition. Do a Google search. Pick up The Mood Cure by Julia Ross, MD, and this can save you so much time and heartache. It can be a real relief, and it can take a lot of the shame out of the situation. And another thing is get support. Find a support group. I think there are a lot of dogmatic attitudes and black or white thinking in some of the more popular support groups. There could be like this cult-like devotion that can be really isolating from people who do not share your new path. It can actually be alienating in a way that I think keeps the addict archetype really charged up and going in your system anyway. So look for people, consciously seek out support from good friends or for a group that is in alignment with your desire to truly surrender. And I'm not a person that is really 90 seconds. Oh, what do I say? Oh, no. I wanted to say so much more. I linked to a story in the Weekly Witch Review a couple weeks back that really resonated with me, in which a woman was saying she does not resonate with the whole, my name is Susie Q and I'm an alcoholic. And that how empowering it is to maybe introduce yourself in a new way to your support group and say, my name is Susie Q. My name is Susie Q, and I am recovering from addiction, or in the process of taking my power back from this addiction. So I wanted to talk about shadow work this week and next week. And let me just wrap up by saying shadow work is something that you do. It is not something that you take on intellectually. It has to be put into practice. And that is why I have made it one of the main focuses for the winter transition module of the Psycho-Spiritual Wheel of the Year. That program is interactive. It was created to not only have a hands-on physical way of processing whatever it is we are working out through the journal prompts, of which there are many, but it also is meant to be a community experience, a support group. And there is, in the private Facebook group, a built-in support system of some of the most kick-ass people I have ever had the honor of knowing. They're just the sweetest. And seeing as the program has been active since the autumn of 2013, that group has really grown and taking on a life of its own. So if you want to join us there and you want to get the winter transition module to work through on your own, you can sign up for that at www.psychospiritualwheeloftheyear. And I will be back here next week talking about the sacred bitch. Woo! Another kick-ass archetype. In the meantime, I send you much love. Peace.